The complicated formula for funding schools in Texas now adds 5 letters and 2 numbers. COVID-19. It's the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
How to fund schools while in the midst of a global pandemic. The push and pull. We'll tell you more. We also learn about the movement born out of the murder of Fort Hood soldier Vanessa Guillen. No Más. What it means to say no more. Have you heard about hygiene theater? Does it make us safer? We'll find out. And we take a look at the growing pains of oil production in Texas, an industry much touted by the president during his visit yesterday. It's the Texas Standard. For many children, schools are the safest place where they can be. It's Thursday, July 30th. This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. The safest place for many children is under tough pressure. Schools are facing the push and pull of many forces while in the midst of this global pandemic. They're feeling pressure from parents as we worry about our children not being able to social distance, not being able to keep a mask on their face all day. But schools are being told now by the Texas Attorney General's office they must reopen or face a loss in funding. Melissa Taboada covers education for the Austin American Statesman, and she joins us now. Melissa, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Please help us understand the guidance from Attorney General Ken Paxton. What does it say in regards to how schools should reopen?
Well, it says that local health authorities can't force school districts to close to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. So school districts that are, you know, making their reopening plans have a little bit of confusion right now.
Yeah.
They are at risk of losing state funding if they shut down campuses solely because of closure orders by health authorities. And that's a reversal from what the Texas Education Agency previously told them. You know, they had been defaulting to local health authorities that issued orders to keep school doors closed and said school districts could continue to get full funding by the state by offering remote instruction so long as those local mandates were in place. And now school districts will have to shift gears and begin in-person instruction within 8 weeks of starting school.
So what does that mean in practical terms for schools that have not made reopening plans?
Well, I would think that most of them have started making reopening plans, but for now, it means if they want to, they can offer remote instruction for up to 8 weeks.
Okay.
They can also just begin school regularly whenever their, you know, previously start date that they voted on comes about. And for some folks, that's going to be after Labor Day. For others, it's going to be, you know, as early as, you know, 2.5 weeks from now.
Is that what you're hearing from school districts as far as their timing, including Austin ISD here in the capital city?
Right. That for Austin ISD, they're starting on August 18th, and they are planning on doing 3 weeks of remote instruction before making, you know, transitions to be in person. As of right now, they have not announced any other changes to those plans. And other districts around the state, you know, also have said that they're sticking to their original plans, but some surely will be changing their dates from here on out.
I know that some of the words that Attorney General Paxton used was nothing in the law gives health authorities the power to indiscriminately close schools. But so far, we have been told to listen to health authorities, sort of like right now, they are the ones that you should pay attention to. So it puts the TEA at a really difficult spot, the Texas Education Agency. Who is the ultimate authority that the Texas Education Agency should listen to, and therefore the ultimate authority that schools should listen to?
That's a great question. And I think there might be some you know, some legal questions that need to be addressed with that. You have at least some school districts that are threatening, you know, a lawsuit over mm-hmm. this guidance. And the guidance is non-binding, but surely it, you know, carries enough weight that the Texas agency, you know, Texas Education Agency would make changes within hours of that guidance coming out. So, you know, Abbott in the past, Governor Abbott has overruled some local mandates, some local orders, including Austin's requirement for everybody to have masks. He's overruled that. So it's possible that he could also overrule the orders of local health authorities. But it seems like, at least in the case of school closures, he has not definitively said one way or the other.
One question that I have is, schools and children have been used as pawns politically in the past. Could that be the case this time around?
Well, certainly people have definitely been saying that this is a political, you know, war. And this, you know, shortly after the guidance came out, Dan Patrick had made comments along those lines saying that health authorities or Democrat judges, county judges, had overstepped their authority by making these guidelines. And then on the other side, you had multiple teacher associations saying that they didn't want to be used within a political war. They feel caught between state and local officials. So definitely that rhetoric of, you know, accusations from the local mandates being political to this guidance being political have come about.
We've been speaking with Melissa Taboada. She's an education reporter for the Austin American Statesman. Melissa, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
New applicants of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals in Texas are facing a lot of uncertainty, especially after this week's decision by the Trump administration to reject new applications. The program is also known as DACA, and in Houston, dozens of these young people are suing the Trump administration as they await their DACA applications to be approved. Benjamin Wormand has been covering this lawsuit for the Houston Chronicle, and he joins us now. Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, can you please tell me about the lawsuit first? When was it filed? You know, what's at the crux of the group, the group that is suing the Trump administration?
Yeah, sure. So it was filed earlier this month, and it's by a group of people who are eligible for DACA but don't have it, who would like to apply after the Supreme Court last month stop the Trump administration from trying to end the program. So they're suing because the Trump administration had, until yesterday, basically been collecting applications, but just setting them aside, not acting on them. And so this is actually one of a couple or a few groups that have sued to try to force them to start taking action on those applications, which the Trump administration announced yesterday it's actually going to start rejecting all of these applications. So this is kind of one lawsuit in a somewhat complicated ongoing legal battlefield.
Yeah, I understand that. What I do not understand is if the decision made earlier this week by the Trump administration to reject the new DACA applications, does that affect the trajectory of this particular lawsuit?
So that's unclear. I mean, the attorneys on the case and the plaintiffs are still pushing the suit and say that they're going to keep fighting for this. A Maryland judge, a federal judge in Maryland, a couple weeks ago now, ruled that the Trump administration needs to take these applications again and consider them, although that judge did not put a date on when they needed to start doing that. So that's kind of when this Texas lawsuit entered the picture, because they were trying to to get a date attached to that and speed up the process. But yeah, now that the Trump administration has said it's going to just start rejecting everything, it's unclear how that affects this lawsuit, but it's also unclear how that affects kind of the ongoing issue in Maryland and where both sides were kind of arguing to a judge on right. When they needed to start this process up again.
Yeah, that was my understanding, that it was back to reviewing applications. People were going to apply. People would have 2 years if they were approved. But now the Trump administration is saying, let's limit that to 1 year for the people who have already been approved, and let's not consider new applications. You know, with so many people that you talk to and so many stories that you hear, I wonder if there's one story, one person that you would like to highlight for us.
I've talked to a couple, or heard from a couple of people who are on this lawsuit, and they both said similar things, which is that, you know, they are, these are young people, and they were in middle school or, you know, early high school maybe when they first heard about DACA, and it's something that they've kind of always wanted. And then, you know, for the last 3 years under the Trump administration, it's been unclear if this is something that they'll ever actually get to have. So there was this brief moment after the Supreme Court ruling where, you know, they felt a ton of relief and excitement at the potential of actually getting to apply for this. And it looks like they're kind of back to where they were before in terms of just waiting and stuck in limbo, which is sort of the cliche with DACA people at this point.
We've been speaking with Benjamin Wermund, and he is the Houston Chronicle's Washington correspondent. Benjamin, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
If you're on Facebook or Twitter or other social media platforms, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, is looking for you, and he's here.
Hi, Joy. Good to be with you. Some sobering news this Thursday. The death of Herman Cain, former GOP presidential contender Herman Cain, dead from coronavirus-related illness. A cancer survivor, it put him in a higher risk category. Many people pointing out that he tested positive for his COVID-19 diagnosis after President Trump's controversial Tulsa rally. David R. Brockman via Twitter says, RIP, though I was never a fan of Cain's politics, this is sad news. And indeed, he points out that Cain tested positive for COVID-19 a week after attending that rally where he was photographed interacting with others without a mask. Mm-hmm. Many people sharing images of a since deleted tweet of Cain's, who is very prolific on Twitter, saying that people are fed up with mask requirements. Another COVID-19 related news, seeing news, Louie Gohmert, Texas Republican Representative Louie right. Gohmert, announcing he'll be treating his positive COVID-19 diagnosis with a discredited drug, hydroxychloroquine. Just one of the stories we're watching today, Joy. I'll be back
Thank
with
you
for more.
Bringing us
yeah,
so much.
Later
yeah.
in the story, later in the show, rather.
Don't go anywhere. Keep your comments coming. This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. During his visit at an oil rig in Midland yesterday, President Donald Trump took credit for Texas being able to reach its full potential as an energy producer.
Under the Trump administration, the United States has increased oil production by 3.1 million barrels per day. That's some number. Never been anything like that number. For the first time in nearly 70 years, we have become a net energy exporter.
But even though there's been growth in the export market, parts of Houston's oil and gas industry continue to be hit hard by low prices and by decreased demand. Houston Public Media's Kyra Buckley checked in with experts to find out where the pain points are.
Companies rely on a somewhat standard playbook when the oil and gas industry goes through a bust cycle. Cut costs where you can and conserve as much cash as possible.
There's another dimension right now is that capital coming into the space for a variety of reasons is a bit constrained.
That's Mitch Fain, U.S. energy markets leader for consulting firm Ernst & Young. He says for years, oil companies have enjoyed the ability to borrow money at low rates. But in recent years, profits are down, disappointing those lenders who now want more in return for their risk.
The supply and demand shock have actually impacted a lot of the upstream independents the most and most dramatically, and it rippled its way through oilfield services.
Upstream companies are among the hardest hit right now because they often use borrowed funds to drill new wells. When times were good, drilling services companies like Houston-based giant Halliburton were doing well. But since the pandemic started, Halliburton has laid off or furloughed more than 4,000 workers in the city. Other oil field services companies have posted losses of $1 billion or more. Even harder hit are the smaller, independent players in exploration and production. They're feeling the most pain. Again, here's Fain.
So they're struggling to keep their teams and rigs working.
Some are still looking for creative ways to attract capital. Others are selling off assets or the whole business to companies with less debt. Earlier this month, Chevron bought Houston-based Noble Energy in a multi-billion dollar deal. More mergers are expected, and that could threaten jobs as companies consolidate. Patrick Jankowski is chief economist for the Greater Houston Partnership.
There's a saying in the oil and gas industry that the closer you are to the drill bit, the more your job is at risk in a downturn.
But Jankowski says the job losses don't stop there.
It's the jobs that go into servicing oil wells. It's the jobs manufacturing the equipment for the wells. It's the pipes, the valves which go to the wells into the pipeline. And it's the engineering jobs, everything it gets designed to find and produce this oil.
He says some exploration and production-related jobs were disappearing before the pandemic. But since the start of the year, some 18,000 people in Houston oil and gas have lost work. Jankowski predicts eventually things will pick up, and some of those jobs will come back. He just doesn't know how many, or exactly when. I'm Kyra Buckley in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm sure you've heard here and in other places about the new viral video promoting the use of hydroxychloroquine as a treatment for COVID-19. It attracted more than 20 million views before Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube pulled it from their platforms. They said the video spread misinformation about the coronavirus. Despite the actions to stop it, though, it continues circulating on WhatsApp, which is owned by Facebook, and on other social sites. Our tech expert Omar Gallaga is here to tell us more about why social media sites are seemingly united in banning this video. Hello, Omar.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I am so glad you're here. Can we start with why hydroxychloroquine is such a controversial subject?
Well, as a treatment for COVID-19, it really has not been proven to be effective, but it continues to be touted by the president and by others as a treatment. And then you have this video staged by a group called America's Frontline Doctors touting it as a cure for COVID and saying, you know, we don't need masks. You know, we've got this treatment. So it is causing a lot of controversy around social media, and the companies like Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube have decided that any kind of misleading medical information like this is just not suitable for their platforms.
Oh my goodness. So they are saying that this should be a treatment, hydroxychloroquine.
Correct. Yeah, that's what. And there are doctors in the video, but it's very unclear as to who they have treated with this, what success rates they've had. There's just not a lot of data in the video to back up what they are saying.
And in this new video, I want to know who produced it and what does it say about hydroxychloroquine and COVID-19?
Actually, the political website Breitbart is who has been putting this out. There's the Breitbart logo is on the video, but it's been kind of whack-a-mole for these social media services as far as taking it down. It keeps getting reposted. It's in other places. It's very easy to find, even though it has ostensibly been banned on these platforms.
And I know that you mentioned in the past the president has touted or did tout the benefits of hydroxychloroquine. Why is he still connected with the video?
Well, he retweeted the video, and so did Donald Trump Jr. Donald Trump Jr. actually was temporarily suspended on Twitter for posting this video. And what Twitter has been doing of late is kind of labeling some of the president's tweets as, you know, having misleading information. But they have stopped short of suspending or banning the president's Twitter account.
And I wonder, you know, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, are they working together to stop it? Or was it just a coincidence that all three of them pulled it?
I think they have been keeping a very close eye on, in particular, the president's accounts. Whenever he posts something to his, you know, 84 million or however many followers, you know, it's a big deal. So they've been keeping an eye on that and flagging those as soon as they get out there. But I think they are each still working independently of each other. They all have slightly different rules on what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And I saw a post from one of Facebook's leaders saying that, you know, they were posting it because of the medical aspect of it, not for any political reasons. Or not for any other reasons, that it was simply because of the misleading medical information in the video.
I wanted to ask you about Breitbart's reaction. I'm sure they're not happy.
Well, what ends up happening whenever any of these videos are taken down, and this happened a few months ago with Plandemic, the documentary, as soon as it gets taken down, then there's cries of, oh, you're censoring information, you know, you're eliminating people's right to free speech, when really it's the platforms just trying to counter bad, misleading, dangerous medical information. So they're kind of damned if they do, damned if they don't. And when they take down a video, people start making comparisons to Nazi Germany and all this, and just taking it to this ridiculous level of censorship, so that they know they're going to face criticism whenever they take down videos like this. Whew.
Omar Gayaga is our go-to tech expert. You can find him at techminutetexas.com. Hey, Omar, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
USA Gymnastics is investigating two coaches who worked at separate Austin area gyms for alleged misconduct with minors. KXAN reports the coaches were placed under restrictions this month that limit their contact with minors while investigations are ongoing. Restrictions were lifted on one of the coaches. He has denied any wrongdoing. USA Gymnastics governs the sport, and it is investigating alongside the U.S. Center for Safe Sport. That organization was formed in 2017 in response to the USA Gymnastics sex abuse scandal. USAG says suspensions like those placed on the Texas coaches are, and I quote, not a finding of misconduct, but an interim measure while investigations are ongoing. Neither coach has been charged with a crime. It's 29 minutes past the hour. It's Texas Standard Time. The Texas Roundup is next.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. At a news conference in Washington, D.C. this morning, the family of Army Specialist Vanessa Guillen shared both their grief and determination to effect change following her murder at Fort Hood in April. They're pushing for a congressional investigation and a new law to make it easier to report sexual harassment that Guillen herself experienced in the military. Her mother and several siblings addressed supporters. That includes her sister, Giovanna Guillen.
We did most of our things together. Every Friday when she would come back home, we would have small sister dates. We would pick each other's clothes and we would go out. Those small special moments I will never forget.
She added, Vanessa fought for them and now it's time they fight for her.
And I promise you we will get justice. I love you, Vane.
The U.S. Army announced today the five civilian experts who will conduct an independent review of the culture at Fort Hood and whether it's committed to preventing sexual misconduct. Amid ongoing protests for racial justice, communities across Texas are renaming structures and public spaces that honor white supremacy or the Confederacy. The Austin City Council on Wednesday approved a framework for its renaming process. KUT's Andrew Weber reports.
Starting in September, the city will begin identifying streets, parks, creeks, anything really, that honors white supremacy or the Confederacy and consider changing their names. The measure requires city staff to present 5 to 10 possibilities every 6 months. Then there will be an education and public input process, as well as a process to suggest alternate names. Then city council could okay changing a name. Councilmember Natasha Harper Madison, who authored the resolution, says it's not a silver bullet, but she called it a step in the right direction.
It would be the height of hypocrisy to say Black Lives Matter while not addressing the elephant in our streets. Confederate Avenue, Plantation Road, and Dixie Drive. These existing street names have no place in the city of Austin.
The city's equity office outlined those streets and dozens more landmarks to rename in a report 2 years ago. Suggestions included Lamar Boulevard, Pease Park, and even Austin itself. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
The number of workers in Texas seeking unemployment benefits for the first time continues falling this month. The U.S. Labor Department reports today roughly 76,000 Texans filed initial claims in the week ending July 25th. Jobless claims have dropped by more than 10,000 each week since early July. More than 3 million Texans have lost their jobs since mid-March when the coronavirus pandemic prompted an economic shutdown. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. Everyone is dealing with the coronavirus pandemic a little differently. I know some of you are taking no chances and you're sanitizing your mail, you're disinfecting your groceries, you're disinfecting your doorknobs, because why tempt fate, right? But according to a new story in The Atlantic, some of us may be going a little too far with our disinfecting. Here to tell us more is the author of the piece. His name is Derek Thompson. Derek, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So can I read the headline of your story?
Yes, you may.
Okay. Hygiene theater is a huge waste of time.
That's right.
Please, let's talk about that terminology, hygiene theater.
Yeah. So let's distinguish, I guess, between hygiene and hygiene theater. I think washing your hands frequently in the middle of a global plague is hygiene. Hygiene theater is a restaurant, like, say, Applebee's, deputizing a sanitation czar to oversee the scrubbing of every windowsill every few hours. Hygiene theater would be a gym chain like Planet Fitness, boasting in advertisements that they're sanitizing every single surface and they're a lean, not mean, virus-fighting machine.
Ooh.
Hygiene theater would be New York City, shutting down its subway for several hours a night, even though thousands of people rely on that subway every single night, in order to blast with antimicrobial weaponry all of the walls and poles and seats. It's these companies and institutions that have made a religion out of deep cleaning at a time when we're dealing with a pandemic that does not seem as likely to spread via surfaces as it does through the air. And so I'm worried most broadly that we are focused on the wrong problem here and that our misallocation of resources might be making us less safe and secure.
But you're not a scientist. I'm not a scientist. So how are our scientists understanding how the virus is transmitted?
So in May, the CDC updated its webpage, its guidelines, to clarify that while COVID spreads easily through the air, that's via large droplets like sneezing and coughing, or aerosolized droplets like people having a conversation and those sort of spray droplets lingering in the air for several minutes afterwards, that's typically how this disease spreads. They said it, quote, it isn't thought to spread through surface areas. There were other scientists that went even further. There was a scientist that I spoke to named Emmanuel Goldman, who's a microbiology professor at Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School. And he's told me that surface transmission of COVID-19 is not justified at all by the science. He reviewed a lot of studies that were done in March, which seemed to indicate initially that this virus could live on surfaces for several days. That's certainly pretty freaky for people opening up the mail or getting food delivery. But he said that the concentrations that were being studied weren't particularly realistic in the real world. So essentially, they were studying, for example, a concentration of this virus that would be the equivalent of, say, about 100 people sneezing on the same square inch of a table. That is not likely thing to happen if you're going to a typical Applebee's. And so they essentially stacked the deck to get a result that didn't bear any resemblance to the world that we live in. And as a result, he said, you know, I'm not saying that people should stop washing their hands or, you know, immediately put all their fingers in their mouth. Nothing like that. Rather that, you know, the prevention measures that need to be communicated have to be clear and they should be done with a sense of priority. And the priority right now is distance, masks, and make sure that if there's an activity that you're doing with more than two people, you do it outside if you do it at all. And that's it. You know, mass distancing and outdoors, those are the most important ways to stop this virus. And if we make people believe that if they only buy the right disinfectant, that they can go about the rest of their lives in normal fashion, that's just not an accurate way to communicate the science of this disease's transmission.
Now, is there anything wrong? Is there anything detrimental if we just continue sanitizing and disinfecting surfaces? Is that so bad?
I think it depends on who we is. I'm not going to say that individual households should stop washing their hands. If they feel like they really want to keep scrubbing down their counters, look, God bless them. The problem is when you have institutions that are responsible for lots of people's lives misallocating their resources. Mm. You have schools saying that they're going to shut down schools in the middle of the week to do deep cleans. This is when they're already running huge budget shortfalls because of the decline in tax revenue. Mm. You have restaurants and gyms saying, we're going to invite people inside our unventilated indoor spaces, and it'll be fine, we promise, because we have a lot of soap and we're washing down the tables. Well, that totally misunderstands the nature of an airborne disease. It doesn't matter how clean the tables are. If people are huffing and puffing the same stale air and passing around aerosolized droplets that are infected by the virus. So the issue that I have is not so much with individuals washing their mail or washing their hands. It's with companies misallocating their resources toward deep cleans when they're not using those resources to keep people distanced and masked, especially when those are indoor locations. If you're a bar or a gym, my hope is that if you're in the area that has a high outbreak, those places are shut down and bailed out. No amount of soap and disinfectant is going to change that calculation.
Derek Thompson is a staff writer for The Atlantic, and we are going to link to his story on Hygiene Theater. That's going to be at texasstandard.org. Derek, thank you so much for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Scott Riggle from Plano, Texas. And I work as a teacher in one of the DFW school districts. My wife and I, we welcomed our first child back on April 3rd. That's when we actually started wearing our first masks, is when we checked into the hospital. And they took our temperatures, gave us a pre-screened COVID wristband, which is going into the baby book. And they gave us a mask and said, this needs to be worn anytime you're not in your room. Being a father of a newborn, I mean, just being a parent of a newborn in general, whether you're mother or father, is in a non-pandemic, it's already very isolating because you can't really do a lot of stuff. The baby demands constant attention. And now with COVID, for those first 6 weeks, we just had to basically dig the moat and pull up the drawbridge, so to speak, and said, no one can come visit us. My mother-in-law, we had her quarantined for 2 weeks before the baby arrived so that she could come stay with us for those 2 weeks. When friends say, let me just come over and I'll watch the baby for like an hour or two and you can take a shower and take a nap and I'll bring over food for you and do all that. And during COVID, and that just evaporated, just went into nothing because we couldn't trust people to come in because we didn't know where they had been. So we haven't been going out much. Still have that mask and just kind of keep it in the car. Now, whenever we do our long walks, we always have our mask in the stroller so that if we walk by someone they can't get off the trail fast enough or something along those lines, we always can just mask up real fast. I think we got like San Antonio Spurs masks. Those were our first ones that we bought offline. And then we bought some from Old Navy and we've got some off Etsy shops. So basically now I have a mask for each day of work, one of those reusable and washable masks. I'm a teacher and I'll be going back, which is a whole different can of worms. You know, as humans, we express so much with our facial expressions and nonverbal communication, even just smiling at someone from across the street. With a mask, you can't really express that. You can maybe see like the eyebrows move up, indicating a smile, but you don't necessarily know. So that's one thing I'm definitely worried about going back to the classroom, because just for the students, like not being able to see their facial expressions, like are they getting it? Are they not getting it? At the end of the day, though, wearing a mask is a slight inconvenience that I would take any day over having COVID. It's just a way of life now. Got to do what you got to do. Well, definitely going to keep them, because you never know when you're like, you're painting something and you need to have a mask for that. Also, just, I mean, I'm sure you've had this experience too when you've gone to grandparents or old relatives' houses and you open up a box and you're like, what is this? And so we definitely want to keep that to show future generations, like, hey, this is what we had to go through. This was an everyday aspect of life in the year 2020 when we had the COVID pandemic. Hi, my name is Scott Riegel. I live in Plano, Texas, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
All right, Texas, it's your turn. This is a unique moment in our history when all Texans have to wear masks, and we want to capture it through your stories. Does wearing a mask pose a specific challenge to you, or have you incorporated it into your accessories? Share your story with us. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, or email texasstandard@kut.org. On Wednesday, in a hearing by the House Armed Services Subcommittee, lawmakers addressed calls to change the way sexual harassment and assault are handled in the military, this in the wake of the murder of Fort Hood soldier Vanessa Guillen. Among the voices calling for change, members of a new organization based out of San Antonio and Houston called No Mas. The group is demanding changes through a new bill they say will keep soldiers and potential recruits safe from sexual assault and harassment. A new Army report released this week showed one-third of 52 female soldiers surveyed at Fort Hood said they have been sexually harassed. No Mas members arrived in Washington, D.C., where the Guillen family will meet with President Trump. Texas Public Radio's Jolene Almendares reports.
No more!
No more!
No more!
Within the first 3 days the No Mas movement officially started, they were in three cities, Killeen, San Antonio, and Houston, where slain Army Specialist Vanessa Guillen called home. Guillen was killed by a fellow soldier in April during her time at Fort Hood. She was missing for more than 2 months before her mutilated body was found. Her family says she was being sexually harassed by the man who killed her and was too scared of retaliation to report it. But the Army says they've found no proof that happened.
Everything started in the wake of the murder of Vanessa Guillen.
That's Janice Gonzalez, co-founder of the No Mas movement. Guillen's death has sparked a Me Too reckoning within the military. Using the hashtag #IAmVanessaGuillen, veterans and active duty military members shared their accounts of being raped, sexually assaulted, and sexually harassed in the military, with little or no punishment for their attackers. Around the same time the issue was going viral, Gonzalez was organizing a vigil and rally for Guillen in San Antonio, while Andrew Rodriguez did the same in Houston. The two connected on Facebook and met in person during a vigil at Fort Hood.
And just right outside the Army recruitment office, just right outside of Fort Hood, he and I stepped away from the vigil and we started speaking to a bigger vision and higher purpose. And that, for us, was the moment the No Mas was born.
In the span of less than 30 days, the organization has rallied at least 40 volunteers throughout Texas, and almost 30 people from other places as far away as Alaska to New York have reached out to the group about hosting their own events or starting No Mas chapters. Thousands of people have attended the vigils, protests, and rallies. Rodriguez thinks he understands how this happened.
When they see Mama Guillen on TV, mothers, they flock to that because they understand that the pain and suffering that she's going to. People understand that this is just unacceptable. People understand that it could have been anybody.
Momentum from protesters has sparked responses from celebrities and Congress who are calling for an investigation into the Guillen case. It's all coming to a head this week in Washington, D.C. The Guillen family is scheduled to meet with President Donald Trump on Thursday, and No Mas will be helping with a march and protest in honor of Guillen. The I Am Vanessa Guillen bill is also slated to be released later this week. It calls for removing the chain of command from the reporting of sex crimes in the military. The No Mas movement has primarily focused on Guillen's case so far, but the organization was founded to help all marginalized voices. This is Rodriguez again.
You know, we're just here to help people. People who may not have the avenue and the means to get their story heard or noticed.
So far, they've collaborated with organizations in support of the Black Lives Matter movement and from the LGBTQ community to stand in solidarity with each other. They hope the alliance of different groups can provide a strong support system to grassroots movements that could benefit everyone. Gonzalez recalled the conversation she and Rodriguez had when they first met in person at the Fort Hood vigil.
We definitely felt transcendent in that we had a higher calling to not just like host one event, but to really rally people, bring and unify communities, and make sure that her message isn't lost.
I'm Jolene Almendarez in San Antonio.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. This week, we're looking at rapid expulsions at the border prompted by a new CDC order that went into effect earlier this year. Since March, the government has carried out more than 70,000 expulsions. Texas Public Radio's Reynaldo Leaños Jr. brings us the story of a young mother he met who attorneys say, by the guidance of the CDC's order, should not have been expelled.
A small apartment on the Mexican side of the Rio Grande is not where this 23-year-old Honduran mother thought she'd be today. She agreed to speak with me if I didn't use her name because she fears speaking out. As we talk, she's trying to get her baby daughter to fall asleep. The tiny girl wears a striped yellow and white jumpsuit with a pink bow on her head. Her story starts last year. She says members of MS-13 started pressuring her husband to join and help sell drugs, threatening the family if he didn't. They left Honduras, she tells me, to seek asylum in the U.S. Her daughter was almost due by late March when she, her husband, and young son crossed the Rio Grande into South Texas. After she crossed, she says, they were detained and taken to a Border Patrol facility. That's when she started going into labor. Border officials took her to a local hospital in the Rio Grande Valley. She shows me paperwork from the hospital confirming she delivered there just after 11 a.m. But she says the next day, she and the newborn were brought back to the Border Patrol facility. She thought they'd be able to join someone they knew that was living in the U.S. Instead, a few days later, they were taken to an international bridge. Border officials told the young mother they were all being sent to Mexico because of the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. wasn't allowing them in, even if they were seeking asylum. In a May press conference, Acting Department of Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf explained it this way.
And that's critically important because what the CDC, as we came into this pandemic, said is Border Patrol stations, we do not need to keep people there for long periods of time.
There are other stories like hers that are getting attention. Lee Gallant is an attorney with the ACLU. They filed a lawsuit against the federal government over this new expulsion rule.
We believe children and asylum seekers can be safely brought into the United States, quarantined if necessary, tested, but that they cannot be denied a hearing, and that the laws Congress passed specifically provide for hearings, especially for children and asylum seekers.
Gallant isn't working with the mother I spoke to, but he is representing a 16-year-old boy who fled Honduras, who is hoping to seek refuge in the U.S., and hoping to reunite with his father, who is waiting for his immigration proceeding here in the U.S. Gallant says in a preliminary ruling, the federal judge agreed with the ACLU and said the boy had a right to apply for asylum.
The government was not going to give this boy an asylum hearing until it got a negative ruling from the judge, and then all of a sudden decided that they would provide this boy with rights. It feels very much like the government does not want the courts to look at their new policy.
They plan on pursuing more cases and representing more families and kids.
The Honduran mother tells me she told border officials they were doing something illegal because her baby was born in America. She says she begged them to please at least let her and her baby stay because she had just given birth and they had nowhere to go in Mexico. The mother says U.S. officials dropped them off at an international bridge. The Mexican immigration officials showed up and told them to leave. Because of COVID-19, the local shelters weren't taking people in. That night, she says, the family slept in a park. As she recounts her story, her daughter falls asleep on her shoulder. Eventually, she says, a local nun helped them find this apartment. Now, they're not sure what's next. They don't have any legal representation. Her husband says they still hope to get their kids into the U.S. and seek asylum. He says they don't feel safe in Mexico. In the meantime, he's gotten a job locally to pay the rent while the family waits for the border to reopen. U.S. Customs and Border Protection said in a statement that they don't have any information about this specific case and cannot comment on it because of pending litigation. The agency also said the expulsion policy doesn't apply to U.S. citizens. I'm Reynaldo Llanos Jr. in the Mexican state of Tamaulipas.
This story is part of a series. You can hear more stories about these Title 42 expulsions at texasstandard.org. And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Social media editor Wells Dunbar is back.
Hi, Joy. Hey, I am. It's true. Good to be with you again, Joy. And, you know, we're continuing to hear from plenty of folks about that story at the top of the show, the non-binding opinion from Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, which nonetheless has led to this Texas Education Agency ruling that it will not fund schools that keep in-person classrooms closed because of local health mandates. Hearing from a lot of people really opposed to this turn of events via Twitter. CL tweets that this is madness. They're going to wait until the death rate is astronomical before they change their minds. Why are they not exploring other options? CL notes that, for example, the Rio Grande Valley medical system is overburdened with cases. Mm. What will it be like a week or so after school starts? And similarly, Faith Cole on our Facebook page says, it seems like this is saying to the schools, when you hear the tornado warning, don't take cover. Wait until the tornado hits and have injuries and deaths to find cover. She goes on to call it strong arm tactics to goose the economy. And as you heard, or as you mentioned rather earlier, Joy, lots of people sort of feeling like they're pawns, essentially, in a game of politics that's being played way above their heads. So lots of anger. Anger and distrust out there. You and I were chatting earlier. Seems to be some sort of rumor circulating on social media, potential for a teacher's strike in Texas.
On Wednesday, the American Federation of Teachers was, I mean, what word do you use? Threatening or warning? I don't know what's the correct term, but of possible teacher strikes in Texas, Florida, Arizona, all states with high COVID cases. So. Yeah.
Those southwestern states where everything is spiking. Well, from the great schools to institutions of higher learning, I think we may have touched on this. UT Austin asking students to self-quarantine for 14 days, 2 weeks before they arrive on campus this fall. Seeing a lot of pushback to this idea. Not in that it's a bad idea, but hey, if you've ever been in college, do you realistically see this happening for a lot of people?
But also, how do you measure that? Do you arrive and then you self-report? Yes, I self-quarantine. Quarantine? I mean, how does that work?
And again, you know, maybe it's not even possible for all the people attending, slated to attend college in the fall. Maybe they cannot do it. UT has asked students to do this as best as they can. I've also seen some sort of some people basically saying this is essentially a way of passing the buck, you know, saying that like once classes, you know, do shut down, should, cases continue to spike, then it's a way of sort of shifting blame, you could argue. On Facebook, Adam Turner argues that this edict is hilarious. It's like asking a toddler to use utensils to eat. Aww. It just isn't going to happen. And Benny Tisdale, Benny predicts that that UT will go full online about 2 weeks or so after school starts.
Wow.
So, obviously there's been discussion of these sorts of metrics, like when will we have to make that call? move from in-person to solely online.
The image of toddlers with utensils. Thank you so much for that, Wells. It was a true honor to be with you. Let's do this again tomorrow. It's the Texas Standard.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.